So Gary Stormo asked me to come and do this, and this is what his words to me were. He sent me an email about how to give this talk, and I don't know what really I should be doing, but I know what I want to do, so I'm going to do what I want to do, and I presume then you guys just interrupt and do whatever you want to do, and it'll end up being what we both want. So this is the formal intentions that I have for this talk about describing this method, which is all SELECS is. It's a method of finding single-stranded nucleic acids that have interesting shapes. And then I'll talk some about what you might do with the molecules, the nucleic acids that come out of this method. And I guess the goal of that would be to make it plausible in your minds that these nucleic acid structures are so terrific that you might be able to do things that you can't do, for example, with antibodies. And so I think that. And so that's a good goal for me to. But that doesn't then do anything but but make it possible for me to tell you how neat all this is, but I don't learn anything back. So that's stupid. So I have a deeper intention, which is to actually show you what this company is trying to do using these molecules. And in the end, I think that this thing we're trying to do, which I haven't told you what it is yet, so you're all sitting there wishing you were somewhere else, but this thing is, I think, a simple, reasonably simple math problem, but I want to give you a sense of what it is, because it's possible some of you who think about these things would like to pitch in some way. So that's the real reason that I wanted to come. Because the first part you could have gotten by just reading all of our papers, okay? It's not so much fun. So this is then the outline. I'll teach you the biochemistry it's simple, and I'll tell you this stuff so that you know it. You'll understand all of it easily. And then I'll briefly, because it's not really your interest, I'll tell you a little bit about how these molecules might have been used as drugs. Maybe they still will be, but I don't think that's where your interests lie. And then I'll spend time on what the company is really about, which is the only thing I'm really trying to do anymore. This is it, this thing called comprehensive proteomics. And after I show you that you can do it, so I'll spend some time trying to convince you that it's also not so hard, but it takes some time to do that. And then I'll show you the kinds of data we're likely to get, because, so you still don't know what comprehensive proteomics is, but I'll tell you, let me say that where we're headed so you know, which is to actually measure the concentration of every protein in your blood. So that's what I mean, okay? Because we think if you can do that, that you can really do wonderful things for healthcare. Okay, so if there's 100,000 different proteins in your blood at concentrations that vary over 6 to 8 logs, something like that, and you measured it all, you could imagine that if you measured that for 100 people who were healthy and 100 people that had some disease, you'd know something about diagnostics. You can imagine that, right? And so that's where we're headed. And that's the math problem that I think is kind of interesting. And I want to talk about that a little bit at the end, okay? So feel free to, if you don't like even this agenda, you could tell me, cut it out, and I'll do something else. I'll show you a tap dancing routine. So this company, SomaLogic, does aptamers. So have you guys heard lectures on aptamers? You have. Okay, well, so I'll do this quickly, because it's amazing. I mean, this stuff's been around for 11 years or 12 years, and you can go to lots of places, and you'll ask in the audience, how many people ever read a paper about an aptamer? Say, you know, there's about 800 papers published or something, and there'll be 3 hands that will go up out of 100 hands. So it's not exactly mainstream science, so I'll act like you don't know too much, but do it quickly, okay? So this is all about... aptamers came from Andy Ellington and Jack Szostak when they first published their first paper. We published a paper, Craig Turk and I, about the method, which we called SELECTS. And they published a paper on the same method, but since we were doing the work independently, they didn't name the process. The process for them was just in vitro evolution that didn't need a name, which was true, by the way. The name SELECTS will disappear, as it should. It's stupid. But the name aptamer seems to have held. And it's because I think they thought that the apt, which came probably from Greek, that part, had to do with stuff looking like other things. But I actually didn't care. It seems to have caught, though. So.
Why they didn't call it binders?
Yeah, ligands. We called them ligands, and they called them aptamers, and it doesn't matter. I mean, so, but it's gonna survive, okay? And in fact, this guy Roger Brent, who you may have heard lecture here, is now using the word aptamers aimed at to describe a class of peptides that bind to things. So that's gonna then confuse things further. So eventually, it will lose whatever trivial meaning it has, okay? All right. Okay, so I'm gonna tell you about these things. Oh, thank you. Does that help? Oh, thanks. Okay. So far I haven't said anything, so you don't have to worry about it, okay? So we invented this process. We really did it in a good way. The we was really Craig Turk. And it was called SELECTS because of that top bullet, systematic evolution of ligands through, so we were calling them ligands, and through exponential enrichment. And it's just in vitro evolution. It's nothing, not a big deal. And the reason that we were all excited, I mean, when we published this paper in 1990, in August of 1990, we actually said everything that's turned out to be true now. That is, we understood something about nucleic acids that was that surprises even us 11 years later. We sort of understood that all the data that I'm about to show you was possible. And the world, of course, thinks that only proteins give you really intricate shapes, and every time you see a nucleic acid with a great shape, a tRNA, you know, or whatever it is, everybody always thinks of those molecules as outliers. It's interesting. See, you can still read textbooks and see people draw messenger RNAs in a textbook as a wiggly line. Well, you couldn't make a sequence of an RNA that was a wiggly line, a random coil, unless, I mean, I don't think you could do it with homopolymers. I mean, I think it's just nonsense, okay? But that is the sort of mindset, you know, there was double-stranded helices, there were wiggly lines, and then there was structure, right? That was the central dogma, was from helix to wiggly lines to structure. And this is all about single-stranded nucleic acids that have structure. So this is sort of as important a slide as any I could ever show you, and there's a few others that are like this one. So I'd like to spend a minute on this. I don't know how many of you have looked at these sorts of things. So the white molecule up there in the left is a single-stranded DNA aptamer, this thing. And the structure is from an NMR experiment. And it was an aptamer, single-strand DNA aptamer that was selected, I'll show you how in a second, to bind to this protein. So this is the crystal structure of the target protein. And all of the different colored atoms on this aptamer are things that either cross-linked this atom to this amino acid, this group to this amino acid, or were footprinted in a classical footprinting experiment. So I don't know how many of you know that, but if you have a nucleic acid, that's the aptamer. You can attack it with lots of chemicals, and then you can attack that thing also in the presence of the protein target. And you get to ask where the interface is because the attack is slower at the atoms that are at the interface. Okay, so it makes sense. And so this surface in here is actually the surface that is protected by binding to the protein. And so the whole point of that slide is nothing more than to say, first of all, an aptamer aimed at a protein makes a big interface. Right? And more interestingly, this structure is kind of bumpy and irregular. And if you didn't know that it was single-strand DNA, which you didn't until we labeled it aptamer, you would think it was a protein. So that, and in fact, that's true for all the classic single-stranded RNA molecules whose structures were ever known, tRNA. We used to give graduate students in exams a picture of an amino acyl tRNA synthetase structure and a tRNA structure, right? Two things that come together. And we'd have them choose which was the protein and which was the nucleic acid, but we wouldn't label the phosphate atoms. And they would get it exactly half right. You can't tell because they're just big globular things. Right? So, is that, are you basing that on looking at that or on something you know? Well, if it does, it this picture, which was a photographic doc, this is dishonest, and this is a real structure and a real structure, and this wasn't tweaked to do that much, okay? And it, whatever was done wasn't real in this side of the picture, so don't think about that. It's actually a fascinating question, which is, when a protein and a nucleic acid do bind, or when any two things bind to each other, which one is doing the induced fit and which one isn't? And even in the area of tRNA with their amino acyl tRNA synthetases that charge them, actually, if you go ask the crystallographers who does the most movement, the protein or the nucleic acid, in that natural setting, they don't know. They have data. And they use the same data to say each answer. Okay, so there are moments where a big chunk of tRNA comes flying over and moves about 9 angstroms to go from here to here to interact with the protein. But then there are also lots of little things that the protein does. So how do you compare those two is hard. We think that aptamers in general, there's a review article about aptamers written by Dinshaw Patel in Science about a year ago, in which he makes the point that when aptamers bind, that's why I asked what you knew, he makes the point that there is a lot of induced fit. But he picked a very peculiar subset of aptamers to look at. And actually, I think that what I'm about to tell you flows mostly from aptamers being like rocks. Okay, so there's a, you know, this is all at the edges. It doesn't have anything to do with the applications of this stuff. But it's interesting, okay? That is great. So what I've said so far is that aptamers have shape and they can come out of the SELECT process. And so now what I'm going to do is spend a few minutes showing you what that process is. It's remarkably simple. Okay, so this is what one does. And as you'll see toward the end of this talk, it's what our robots do at this company, SomaLogic. So we make a sequence library of double-stranded DNA with a random region in here and fixed sequences on the end. So the fixed sequences are so you can amplify the stuff and do rounds of this selective process. So you define a sequence, there's some art to it, but not much, and a length. And then you just make that chemically. Okay, and we use usually 30 to 40 nucleotides of random region between the primers sites. And then the sequence library gets converted with enzymes in a test tube to a single-stranded library. The idea, which is borne out by experiments, is that the sequence library, which is not a shape library, because this is just a helical, this becomes then the shape library because of all the intramolecular things about which we know terribly little. I mean, we know only really in detail about how to predict, and there we're not right all the time, helical regions, nothing else. And of course, I didn't say this to you, but I will. I can use this slide while it's up here. What's really interesting, you can't tell from looking at this, but most of the interesting atoms in the aptamer that contact the protein are not from helical regions of the aptamer, but are from loops. So, and it's the loops we don't know anything about. Okay? That we can't, if I gave you a hairpin loop with some 4-nucleotide loop and said predict its structure, unless it was one of the 3 structures that is already known, you wouldn't have a clue what to do. Is that true? Say yes. So, you know, if you don't want to say yes, don't say yes. So you turn this thing into a single-stranded library. It could be RNA, it could be DNA, it doesn't matter. The idea is that it folds intramolecularly. And then you simply select from that single-stranded library the things that bind to whatever your target is. And this has been done now for I'm sorry, yes? Say it one more time.
Binding should imply a certain latency, that is the energy of that. Does anybody measure what is it like?
Well, I can tell you what, no. I can tell you everything I know about what's been measured, and you can tell me if you can calculate what you would like to know from what's been measured. So what's been measured for sure, for every complex I'm talking about, is the equilibrium binding constant. So that's the first thing. And those are known, and I'll show you some data for that. What's been measured for a reasonably large number of these things is the dissociation rate constant. So you can sort of figure out the association rate constant. And we know a little bit about that, that they're often diffusion limited. And a couple of times they've been measured to be slightly faster than like a factor of 10, as though they're sort of sucking their targets toward them in some. So let's agree I'm on thin ice, but those are the data. And no one has ever measured with any kind of calorimetry or any of that kind of stuff, anything else of any interest, probably.
But that means that you can estimate the binding energy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we know what the... Well, can I do that in units that I'm comfortable with? So my working biochemical units, I don't do delta G's or energies or like that. I do KD's. Can you go from KD's to what you want? I know you can. So the binding constants, the dissociation, the equilibrium dissociation constants are between 10 to the minus 9th molar and 10 to the minus 12th. Okay. As soon as one of these things happens, I'm always looking for a cab to get out of here because it's really neat that people know things differently. All right, so. What I am going to show you is that these things bind unbelievably tightly, and they bind so that for biochemistry, those KDs that I just handed you are really tight, and I'll say more about that in comparison with antibodies and other things in a second. So how you find them is you just select them. You simply put the protein, if that's the target, into a tube with the library, and then isolate the complex away from the library. We start typically with 10 to the 15th or so of these molecules. And because they have those fixed sequences on the end, you then just cull from that group. As you go through this process and repeat it, you essentially end up with a small number, a handful or so, of different sequences that are the winners in this thing. The thing, the aptamers or so, okay? Then you clone and sequence and figure out what you got. So it's really, really simple, okay? And all, yep, okay.
Is there a mutation introduced?
Not intentionally, but it for sure happens.
But you're relying on the study random library.
Yeah, and the reason is, the beautiful thing about this is, is that at 30 or 40 N, you're starting with this many sequences, and so people always do. There's a classical experiment in the literature of this stuff that at the end of getting a winner, someone, usually the PhD thesis advisor, says to this poor kid who worked hard to get that winner, gee, I wonder if there are minor variants that make it better. And so there's this experiment where you dope the winner and you do it again, even though you'd like not to. And sometimes you get back only what you started with, and sometimes you get something that's five times better. The KD's five times lower, but it's a lot of work to get that extra fivefold. So this is already a very rich sequence diversity. Okay.
That improvement is from mutation.
Well, they're intentionally put in. So people will take the winning sequence and make it as the starting library, but doping in all the nucleotides at that position as though there's a close variant that you didn't get to by mutation during the selection itself. But for sure, the PCR steps are introducing mutations. And you quite often get things that look clonal. They look like there was a clone and then mutations because you sequence enough guys, and so you can think of it that way too.
In realizing when having a representative sample of your sequence space, the length 40, by the length becomes...
Well, it's not so good at length 40 either. It's one in a billion. Okay, so if you do the same experiment in two labs, I make a 40-mer library, you make a 40-mer library, we have almost no overlap. And that's been done. We've done a lot of that. And you actually, I'll show you in a second a slide where you kind of understand that you don't need to saturate this to get the kinds of molecules you get. Oh, I know that. I know by experiment and by actually something better than intuition, which is actually a fact of sorts. So this is all dependent on classic single-stranded RNA or single-stranded DNA secondary structures. And there are only four of them that we know a lot about. There are hairpins with loops, stems with bulges, so the bulge is a structure that's slightly different than an unbulged stem. There are G-quartets and there are pseudonots. And that's it. And everything else that you make with this length of material is one of those four things, okay? And it turns out with 20 nucleotides, you can make hairpins, but not much else. And with 30 nucleotides, you can make all of the things I just said. And we've done experiments with 20N, 30N, and 40N a lot. I mean, we've done this, I don't know, 400 times over the last 11 years, something like that. It's hundreds. I don't know whether it's 300 or 400, but it's a lot. And when you use a library of length 20, where the random region is 20, you practically never get anything interesting. So that's compatible with what we know about secondary structures, because most of what you get is not a simple hairpin, which is the only thing you can easily get out of 20 nucleotides. Does that help? You're going to love this answer, but I'm going to give it to you anyway. So the way you make it operationally is you start on your Applied Biosystems DNA synthesizer machine at whatever scale you want. Call it a micromole for the sake of discussion. And then you make, for every cycle, a nucleotide that you've chosen here, and you're going in that direction on the top strand. And then when you get here, you put in the four phosphoramidites. Sometimes people put them from here to there, equal molar. Sometimes people adjust a little for what they think are the attack rates on the growing chain. And the amount of work that's been done to actually clone and sequence starting libraries to make sure that the mono and dinucleotide distributions are random is almost zero. Because this works so well, no one cares. That's the part I knew you were going to like. And then you get to the other end, and you make a fixed sequence, and then you make a primer here and fill it in, and that's the library. But the amount of work, I mean, even us, we're pretty good. I think we're the best in the world at this stuff. And even us, the libraries we're doing, we don't care. You don't ever have a moment where you say, gee, that experiment didn't work because the library sucked. You don't do that, because it works. We used to talk about doing these things with only two nucleotides. You know this Vechterhauser guy? That guy, there are papers about the all-purine world. So wouldn't it be fascinating to do this with just A's and G's? So I would walk around the lab once a month and say this. And nobody ever thought it was even worth thinking about, let alone doing. But, you know, so I don't have any strong feeling that the biases are important. Okay. So you don't need to know about that. So that's the process. So it's really simple, okay? So let me show you a little bit about what kinds of data you get when you clone and sequence at the end of the process, because it's kind of interesting. And Gary Stormo, who many of you know, has spent a lot of time looking at the pools of sequences to see what, you know, what you can learn from them. So here's an experiment in which two different lengths were done. So clearly these two libraries had very little overlap. They were made independently, and so call it one sequence and a billion were identical over their 30 nucleotides, since this one was 50 long in the random region, this was 30. And what happened was, in this particular selection experiment, where the target was this thing, it doesn't matter, it's just a protein, there was a way to line up the sequences from both libraries around their identities or their homologies or whatever word you use, and they're shown here in red for this. In this published paper, there were many more sequences than this, so you actually could see a consensus. So if this consensus was terribly important, then you'd have to have enough overlap in the in both libraries for them to be there. But this is short, and so these kinds of sequences would be there. You see, sometimes it's right up against the fixed region here. Sometimes here's some more fixed sequences. Here's one that's entirely within the random region. And after you looked at this a little bit, it turns out that the consensus, which was really starting at this nucleotide and going around and ending at this, because this was most often a C in the last slide, a CG, was then followed by helical regions. And you can see here's a long one. So this is an example where the consensus is up here and it's sort of held together. And I think that this is actually probably central to why these things work. So this helix that you have down here is really doing nothing more, I think, than organizing this stuff so it can form a structure. So this is the part that I guess is entropic or something, and this has got to form some interesting structure. And probably if you had a way of just clamping this right there, the length of the helix wouldn't matter to the binding of this aptamer to its target. And that experiment's not been done. But that's the way I tend to think of this, that the single-stranded regions are all the action, and the double-stranded regions are helping to get the single strands organized. Okay.
So would you expect another sort of entropic region, like the upper double strand?
Well, this one didn't vary. You mean right here? Yeah, well, that one you can't say anything about because you don't have any covariations. So if you look up here, I think we could find this. There's the GGU, here's a C. So this is the only one that covaried, so I don't know what to say about that, okay? Whereas there's a lot of covariation down here. So this is, you guys who think about this sort of thing must have arguments about this all the time, about how much variation you need to know that it's all about structure, not about something else, I guess. So I don't know. So this is then, let me do it this way. These two slides were the same. So this is a distribution of the data. This is a comparison of apples and oranges, and I apologize, but it's still pretty interesting. So this is what I just said to the question, how good is the binding? So these are the KDs for lots and lots of selects experiments done against lots and lots of different proteins where the libraries were either RNA, DNA, or special fancy modified RNA libraries, which we've done a lot of. And all of the data are put in one table because, in fact, we never saw any difference between RNA or DNA. That is, there wasn't one library that was better than the other three. I'll come back to that in a second. What was amazing is about half of the select experiments that we did with protein targets gave aptamers, winning aptamers, whose KDs were 100 picomolar. And if you'd have asked, say in 1990, the average molecular biologist whether they thought on the average you would get a KD of around 100 picomolar for some just random protein, thrombin, you know, some protein that has nothing to do with nucleic acids, there wasn't anybody who believed that this could work. Okay. And to make the equivalent of antibodies. No one.
Huh? Do you know whether 100 picomolar, do those aptamers also bind to other proteins?
Well, I'm going to show you that. These are unbelievably specific. These are both tighter binders than antibodies and more specific. So yeah, we do. We know a lot about that. In fact, by the end of this 2 hours, you'll be screaming for help, because the whole issue is about, to do what we want to do, specificity is the whole issue. So this is, to most people, a surprise. And these are monovalent interactions between the aptamer and the protein target, and they're measured in solution. Okay, so there's none of this. So those of you who think about these things know that if you put a patch of an antibody on a plate and ask about the binding of something to it, when it binds, it tends to dissociate more slowly than it would in solution, because as it's trying to get away, it sort of wanders around the shrubbery. And that sort of concept is called avidity, where it's never very carefully defined. But I think of that as something which is an attempt to get away, but you don't get away because you rebind, because you're essentially right there. You're 5 angstroms away and you grab something else. So these measurements are made in solution. And they're shockingly... These mostly come from making the aptamers radioactive and then doing pseudo first order binding curves with very tiny amounts of aptamer, adding protein, and essentially capturing the complex and counting them. Okay. So they're, it's not perfect, but it's easy. Okay. When people have looked, and this box over here is made up by me. This is published nowhere, but it represents reading patents and reading papers and talking to people who make single chain antibodies. So single chain antibodies, as opposed to regular antibodies, are also monovalent. And so it seems to me that we ought to be comparing monovalent antibodies with monovalent aptamers. And the binding constants are about 1,000 times higher from this pseudo literature that I've read carefully. This literature, I put this in last night because I don't want to mislead you. These numbers are going to come down, because what's happened is that people who desperately want to take advantage of antibodies, where we know so much about how to use them, and know that they're not good enough, believe it or not, compared even to aptamers, have figured out ways to make bigger libraries. And there's for sure a relationship between the size of the library and the KD that you get when you select. It can't be a simple relationship, but there's got to be one. And what's happened is people have raised the library size by about 3 or 4 logs, 5 logs maybe. These KDs are coming down. So that's good for, okay?
Why doesn't nature use aptamers?
I don't know. I wasn't there. I think that once you say that you want secrete, for sure this is about things that got locked in a long time ago. You could have, okay? You could have used... could have said the same thing when Tom Check did ribozymes. You could have said, why do we have protein enzymes? Now we know the answer, because they're better is the answer. But this is the other direction. I agree with you. There aren't many big polyanions that get secreted from cells. So maybe if your genetic stuff is a big polyanion that you don't want to make the risk of transport systems, I don't know. The nucleic acids are also not, unless you fool around with them, not stable to the enzymes we have today. But you're really asking a question about a long time ago. And so it seems it's an entirely great question. You just don't know.
Perhaps it's much more nucleases and proteases, right?
Well, I think there's a lot of both. A lot of both. We know a lot about this. I mean, it turns out that solving, I was going down that path, but I thought better of it, because we had to solve the problem of nuclease stability in order to put aptamers into human beings or animals and use them as drugs, and it wasn't hard. So it's a legitimate question, what I think. I'm sure not going to talk about that. So then this is about specificity, okay? So this is one of these slides I love. So, you know, you have lots of audiences in the world, right? They include investment bankers. And this is the kind of slide they like, because you have no idea what this comes from. I'll show you an example of this in a second. But to a first approximation, these things are, again, more specific than antibodies. I think I understand why. But let me show you the kinds of experiments. There's a lot of data buried in this slide. Here's just a stunning piece of data from 5 years ago or so. We made an aptamer that bound to basic fibroblast growth factor. So that's a protein. Doesn't matter with what it is. And that protein, that aptamer bound with a KD of just under 1 nanomolar. It was about 200 picomolar KD. And so we called that 100. And then we asked how well that one aptamer bound to all of these other proteins. And what we found was that it bound really poorly, so I think it goes from here up, really poorly to other members of the basic FGF family that are 60 to 70% identical. So that's already pretty amazing. These proteins from PDGF down are proteins with an incredible capacity to bind to polyanions, which an aptamer is. I mean, it's phosphate, right? Polyphosphate. So PDGF is a notoriously avid binder to polyanions, and it binds 1,000 times worse to this aptamer than it does to than the correct protein. These proteins here all have heparin binding sites, so they have a pocket for binding a polyanion, and they don't bind the aptamers that were evolved for other proteins. And in fact, this aptamer here, the one that binds the basic FGF, binds in the basic FGF heparin binding site. So the heparin binding site's got little, you know, lysines and arginines in there. And the aptamer goes in and likes it. That's the dominant epitope. And even though that's where it binds, the heparin binding sites on different proteins are different. And the aptamer must be sufficiently rigid that all those intraphosphate distances don't get re-induced to go and bind in all the heparin binding sites. So this is kind of a part of the data that drives me to thinking that they're not wiggling around so much. Heparin, on the other hand, is in fact really almost a random coil, and so it has no trouble adjusting to different heparin binding sites. That's what I think. Okay? But this kind of data is wonderful. Okay? Oh, you can make a single base change and lose it completely. Okay, you can.
What about pH and ionic?
Every one of those. We've looked at all of them. So when you're going to do what we're trying to do, which you'll see in sort of in the second half of this thing, you've got to know the conditions you're going to use them, and you want to evolve them and select them under those conditions. Otherwise, you're making a big, big mistake. So for those things that are going to be used in serum, in an animal or in a human, you want the conditions where you select them to be those conditions. Well, it varies. That some can be, you have no control over that. It's an unselected phenotype, is I guess the way I would think of it. And so you just don't know. You get everything. So we've done experiments where we've done selections in EDTA, and then asked about the metal sensitivity. Some are, some aren't. We've done them in the presence of metal and asked about the EDTA sensitivity. Some are, some aren't. So you get, I think this is all about unselected phenotypes, I think.
Is there any data for the reverse of this picture? For a given protein, what is the distribution of affinity of the aptamers, like in the pool of
aptamers? I desperately want to understand that question, and I don't. So
you produce like number of sequences quite randomly. So having just chosen one protein, like in this case BFGF, could you get the data for the distribution of affinity of that protein to all these sequences.
Yeah. Well, actually, so could I? So the answer is nobody's ever tried to do that. But it is. There's a math paper written by it. So I refer to math papers as anything that's hard for me. And there's a paper written by a guy named Doug Irvin in JMB around 1992 that actually tried to answer that question with no. There are no data. Okay, so you know you'd start with poly U, poly A, poly G, poly C. You take a protein, you measure the KD, then you'd start making other things. You make sort of bulk KDs. We have a lot of bulk KD measurements. I know what the KD is for the dominant thing in a pool because we always measure that, and that's usually 3 to 8 logs worse than the winning aptamer for every protein. Okay, so that's a fact. But what that doesn't tell you at all about the distribution, and that's what you're really asking about. And no one knows that. What we do often is we measure the bulk KD of the evolving pool during the selection, at the end of every round. And so we see the KDs dropping, and then at some point they don't drop anymore. And so you say, we're done. And then you clone and sequence. But what hasn't been done is to do cloning and sequencing of all the rounds and do a complete analysis of what it means to evolve a winner, which is what you're asking, which would be a great academic exercise. It's just never been done.
Yeah. I have a very question. I just wanted to make sure I understood the answer. So evolving an aptamer has such a high specificity does not, in general, infer upon it any more sensitivity to mutations or perturbations than perhaps you'd expect for normal enzyme binding. Is that true? Is that what you're saying?
I didn't think I said that, so I want to make sure. So I don't understand that question either, actually, even though I may have answered it.
In the sense that protein or enzymes might have a certain degree of robustness to mutation or to other environmental fluctuations.
We wouldn't have a clue. So if I answered that in some way that you could infer from what I said, I didn't mean to, because that's a different experiment entirely, I think, than anything that's been done. So you have to remember that the key thing here that makes the two worlds you're talking about, I think, orthogonal, I think, is that, so I don't know that protein literature you're talking about, but here's what I think you're really saying, okay, what that data that you referred to must say, that if this is the protein and that's the active site, that the proteins probably are gonna be reasonably insensitive to mutations all around them to maintain the active site. So if the aptamers went into the active site of enzymes, if the dominant epitope on a protein, on an enzyme, was the active site of the enzyme, then those things would be less orthogonal. But I think that, I know, in fact, that that's not the case. The only place you can get an active site as the dominant epitope for getting an aptamer is when you do nucleic acid binding proteins or heparin binding proteins. And so they're really two different worlds.
What is the difference also to your strength with aptamers? You have 2 aptamers, one which has specificity of 100 here, and another one on an earlier round which only has specificity of 10.
Uh-huh.
So an order of magnitude less. Mm-hmm. And now you started making small perturbations either in conditions or in the sequence of that evolved aptamer. You find that the more highly evolved, the higher binding one, is more sensitive to
perturbations. I understand the question. Nobody's ever done that. Nobody's ever done any of that kind of hard work with anything but the winners. I've not read a single paper that addresses that question. It's a great question, now that I understand it. Well, but it's sort of similar, because you end up, I mean, even though they're not phylogenetically related to each other, they are a sequence set that have something structural to do with each other. And very early in the selection, very early, the dominant epitope starts winning. So every aptamer in the final pool will block the binding of every other aptamer to that protein. So dominant epitopes are operating here, and no one knows quite how early that's true, but it's probably pretty early. So your question, even if they're not related sequences in some evolutionary sense, because it's just culling, they're still in the same site.
This is actually somewhat surprising. If you said change of one base could change the inactiveness of the aptamer, could change this picture quite a bit, then since your starting pool doesn't cover everything, so why should you expect your...
Well, I mean, because it turns out to make a really high affinity motif, you don't really use whatever the right phrase, 60 bits of information. You're using a lot less than 30 nucleotides.
You can slide
around, and then you have NN primes for helices. And so the number of absolutely rigorously defined nucleotides is always very few. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's another experiment that's never been done, which we've talked about only for 11 years. So it's a fantastic experiment. You know the answer for antibodies, in sort of, okay? You know that when you really drive an antibody selection in vitro or in vivo, you get a dominant epitope, and it's one, okay? But deep down in your heart, you know that if you took the antibodies from a monoclonal experiment where you disperse some animal's spleen into a test tube early in the immunization process, that you're going to get a lot of weak antibodies to epitopes that are completely different. And so deep down, you think that the number of epitopes on a protein for the immune system is the entire surface of the protein as the conformational epitope set, however you define what overlap means. And for the linear epitopes, which are, you know, unstructured, 7 or 8 or 9 amino acids in length, you basically think you can walk right down the protein, and every one is a new epitope. Deep down, that's what you think. Because we've had so much experience with weak binding antibodies that help you come to that conclusion. But we don't have that experience with weak binding aptamers. So we tried once to see the second best epitope. You can imagine that experiment. So we selected the winners, and then we took off from a winner the amplification signal, and said, let's do this again, but now in the presence of that blocking, unamplifiable aptamer, so that it'll be sitting there, and now we'll select something to the other epitope. It was a simple experiment. But of course, these were not covalently bound. And they were doing this and this and this, and while they were off, the dominant epitope was available, and so then we got the same thing again. So we couldn't do it. So we don't think that's right. We think that's an experimental artifact. That if you held it there, which is what the whole second half of the talk is about. And so we could now do that experiment, right? But we didn't. I don't care about this. If we talk a lot about a lot of stuff, I'll just skip things I think you don't care about. You don't care about this. So this one's pretty interesting, actually, for people who think about nucleic acid structures. Because we weren't sure when we started whether we were going to do RNA or DNA or modified RNAs that were modified against nucleolytic attack, so we did a lot of pyrimidine experimentation where the C's and U's had, instead of 2' OHs, 2' amino or 2' fluorine. And the reason is that the 2' OHs of the pyrimidines are responsible for the nucleolytic attack on an RNA in serum. So we had to do these things. And so this slide was one of the few proteins, probably there were 4 proteins that we actually made aptamers, winning aptamers, from each kind of library, regular RNA, you know, 2' OH, 2' H DNA, or pyrimidine-modified RNA libraries where the purines were 2' OHs and the pyrimidines were 2' amino or 2' fluorine. So when you looked at the winners, you know, you can do what you want when you look at these, but they're not the same sequences. And there was then experimentation done where you'd take, for example, this guy, and you'd make that same sequence as DNA or as regular RNA or as this thing. They don't bind at all. So all of this slight structural difference you get when you use these different, you know, things, lead to the loss of activity. You can't go from RNA to DNA. So again, in the same way about how do you do the selection, if you know you're going to do DNA aptamers, you don't select them as RNA. If you know you're going to do RNA aptamers, you don't select them as DNA. You just can't go back and forth. And I put this on last night because to my, you know, you love looking at secondary structures and so you think, well, since this we knew was part of the conserved thing for this thing, is that related to that? Is that related to that? Who knows? You just don't know, right? You know that they bind in the same site, meaning that you can't put both of them on the protein at the same time, but that's all you know. All right, you don't care about that, 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 you don't care about that. It's pretty good. Let me show you, do you care about this? No, you don't care about that. Okay. So this is then, I can't see without my glasses what time it is. That'll help. I can see that. Don't say it. I saw it. I can read it. And you stop at like 11 o'clock or something, is that what you do? Okay. So this is like a good place to stop. Two or three more slides. So we had this company, Nexstar, it was a company that we founded around this technology, and we wanted to make drugs. This is a summary of an unbelievable amount of work and an unbelievable amount of money. And this company spent over a 10-year period, my company spent $125 million on this technology. And every experiment that got done in animals, every experiment, and there were a ton of them, worked exactly as you had hoped, as we had hoped. We were able to image tumors in mice. There were some slides about that. We were able to block, you know, kidney malfunction. We were able to do a lot of experiments that worked. And all that led to, after that period, was one molecule, one that I actually had slides in there, which is now in the clinic for treating something called age-related macular degeneration, which is a disease where older people wake up in the morning and the center of their vision from one eye is sort of got a hole in it. And it's because of what turns out to be a disease of new blood vessel formation in the eye, and it's awful. And there's no treatments, and there's no nothing, and it, you deteriorate. It's a bad disease. And we ended up making a great compound for that, and it's now in clinical trials by the company that bought Nexstar and then sold the drug to an ophthalmology company. So that thing is for all that money and all that time. So it's actually an amazing story about biotech, right? We were considered to be reasonably successful. This is a hard business, okay? And that thing may work, but there were problems that I now understand. The cost of making these things in amounts sufficient to give people is high. That's not good. But that's what cost of goods is. And the other thing that's true is the pharmaceutical industry is absolutely unwilling to inject people with drugs. So to a first approximation, the pharmaceutical industry is about orally active drugs. So if you think about what we've been talking about specificity and all that kind of stuff, if you had, from what you know right now, if you had to bet whether a small molecule, so orally active compounds are never more than a molecular weight of 700, so that's about the cutoff. So if I said to you, can you make routinely a compound of a molecular weight 700 with the specificity that I've been telling you about, that aptamers have? You know you can't. So toxicity is all about that. I mean, toxicity is all about two things. One is about specificity, and the other is if you inhibit a protein that you need in some other part of your body, that's not good either. So those are the two forms of toxicity. And in spite of the fact that we were able to show over and over and over that these things are not toxic in any way to animals, that we just could not get the guys with all the money to think about it. So there came a moment. I'm not whining, I'm not complaining, I'm just telling you. Where we started about 5 years ago, before we sold our company, to go after a totally different area than what we've been talking about. which is shown up here, which is to make chips, like Affymetrix chips. So you know what chips are, chips where you make a lot of measurements, and where the chip would have tons of aptamers, and we'd measure proteins. So we'd be using the aptamer the same way you would use antibodies in clinical diagnostics. And that's what I want to talk about, because there's these amazing set of tricks that make this possible that would be for the second half of this talk. So for what I plan to do in the second half is show you what it is we're doing, because that's going really well, and then get to the part of that where the math could use some help. Okay, so can we get coffee? Is that okay? Okay, so you have the hang of this at this point. You know that aptamers are special. And we were just having, Thomas and I were just having this conversation about how they may even, at some fundamental level, I think, may be more interesting as shapes than proteins, which is really going beyond the data. But so we can have that conversation if you want. So I want to spend maybe 10 or 15 minutes showing you how you can apply this to high-density chips, and then get to where I think the math maybe would get interesting and maybe would tickle somebody's fancy. So everything I've been talking about so far has been about these aptamer things that bind and dissociate. So they associate, dissociate. And I have this, we had this fantastic moment, not me, but we, about 8 years ago, where we realized we could make the binding covalent. And if you can make the binding covalent, then it leads to some really interesting possibilities. And so I want to tell you a little teeny bit about photoaptamers. And they're actually more or less the same thing as an aptamer. The difference is, instead of making a photoaptamer out of single-stranded DNA, we make photoaptamers out of single-stranded DNA that have no T's in them. So we get rid of one of the four letters and replace the T with 5-bromodeoxy-U. So 5-bromo, so that means the bromine is sitting on the base where the methyl group of T sits. Okay, so for those of you who know pyrimidine structures, and this, it looks the same to the polymerases, you can still do a photoselects process, but when you do it, you not only select for binding, which is shown up at the top, up here, but you can actually take the complex and shine a UV light on it. And if you shine a UV light at the right wavelength for the right length of time, you can get a cross-link between the bromo part of a bromodeoxy-U in the library to an electron-rich amino acid. So you can actually make a covalent complex. And remember, at the ends of the libraries, we had sequences that were the fixed sequences, so you could amplify. And all you have to do to be able to amplify is to protease digest the complex. And so you actually have only these two differences in the selects process. And you get things that not only bind with great KDs, but also can make a permanent bond. Okay? Does that make sense? Well, that's, I don't have a slide of that, but if you had a, so this is the RNA, or the DNA rather, that is folded up in the aptamer, and now you got a protein that's about that big, and it's cross-linked right in the center of the aptamer. In order to then amplify from fixed B to get the pool amplified to do another round, you have to get rid of the protein, but it's covalently bound. And it turns out that if you protease digest the complex, the little peptide or amino acids that are left on the what was once bromodeoxy-U don't stop the replication from this primer, because the 5 position of the pyrimidine is a non-base pairing position.
So the photo part is just making the KD even bigger.
Well, it makes it permanent. Yeah, but this is to select it. So you digest it, but then later what's going to go on the chip is going to be a photoaptamer, and it's going to permanently bind the protein so you can measure it. Okay? So that's the idea. So why do we do this? I mean, why do we care about this? And there were lots of reasons. Some of them are here. I'll show you a little data. You get more specificity. But also, if you think about a chip, the whole business of measuring proteins at low concentrations is actually about not signal, but noise. So you like to be able to wash hard, and if the aptamer is on a chip covalently and the protein is bound to it covalently, and then you make some stain that's covalent, you can wash the thing really hard. And so it's all about this kind of thing to make the data stronger. So I won't show you about that. So here's the idea about specificity. This is just an idea. The whole talk I've given up to here is to the left of that over here. What I've been saying is that aptamers are great at binding tightly to their target proteins, and this dissociation rate constant is slow, and that when a protein that we don't care about binds to that same aptamer, its dissociation rate constant is fast. So that's where I guess all the specificity has been coming up until this point in the talk. Now what I'm saying is that that complex can be selected in this photo-selects process to give a very rapid photo crosslink. That is, that crosslinking rate constant will be fast because we're selecting for the bromodeoxy to be in a particular configuration in the complex with an amino acid to which it can crosslink, and that it seems unlikely that anything that was gratuitously bound would have that same opposition, that direct contact within an angstrom or two, and therefore this would be slow, and therefore we would have not only the ratio of that to that as a specificity determinant, but the relationship of that to that. In fact, to this. That's fast, this is slow. So in a way, I think this scheme, for those of you who read these things, is very much like Hopfield's kinetic proofreading, I think, okay? For those of you who read these things, and therefore we have two steps of specificity, and we get to multiply the specificities, and it should be great, okay? That's the idea. And it turns out experimentally it is. So we made a photo aptamer using that technology. Oh, you can barely see it, but it's okay. That's its sequence. So there are no T's. They're just B's for bromodeoxy-U in this photoaptamer. This is the protein to which it crosslinks. This is the amino acid to which it crosslinks. And it turns out that it's all of the crosslinking is one of the B's, not any of the other five. That's the experimental data. So I want to show you an absolutely stunning experiment. I think this is about as stunning as it gets. So before, when I showed you a picture of the aptamer, I said, remember this, this is a great slide. So this is the other great slide. This is like our flag, you know, in this company of ours. So I want to walk through this experiment really quickly, because it's actually a remarkable. It's not on a chip, but I'll explain the experiment. Okay, so just look here, right here. So this is the photoaptamer whose number was 0650, that's its number. It was prepared as a radioactive DNA and run on a gel. So that's the band of the purified aptamer 650 run on a gel, okay? We then did what's called in molecular biology a gel shift experiment, but an unusual kind of experiment, where we added a low concentration of the target protein, basic FGF, 3 picomolar, in this tube, in a little tube. We waited 5 minutes for an equilibrium to be reached. We shine the UV light at the right wavelength on the complex, and then we ran the mixture on a gel, and you see some of the radioactivity, instead of running here with the aptamer, runs here. So that's called a gel shift. It's because of the extra mass of the protein making the complex run slower. And the shift is surviving the conditions of the gel, which are denaturing conditions. So a normal gel shift experiment is done under so-called native conditions, so that you're retaining the binding. But here the protein has been intentionally denatured. But because it's physically cross-linked, covalently bound to the aptamer, the gel shift still works, okay? And so this is a titration going from low to high protein, kind of, and you see this band coming. So that's not a surprise, since we selected the molecule to do that. That's not a surprise. This is the same experiment as that, done in 10% serum. So this is buffer, this is serum. And you're supposed to say, holy moly, or whatever one says at the ITP, you say, ergo, or whatever you say. I don't know what you say. But there aren't any other bands. It isn't as though some other protein in the serum grabbed this thing and made this band move up in here. So this is the critical lane. So here's in serum, here's not in serum. And you're supposed to think, my goodness, this is pretty clean, as though this argument about specificity from Hopfield-like discussion about two steps in the specificity is sort of right. So we've done a lot of this, okay, with these things. And we think that we're going to be able to put on chips, so this is in solution, this is not a chip, but we think we're going to be able to put photoaptamers in high-density arrays on chips and measure everything, okay?
You
can't do it quite this way, but quantitatively, so there's not enough data to answer. I'm not trying to be squirrely, I don't want to exaggerate. I think that it's probably 500 to 1,000 on the average, extra fold in specificity, which is enough to get you where we want to be. So let me tell you what the real metric is, and there'll be somewhere. There's almost none, and there'll be some maybe where it's more. We haven't done enough to really know. So these next three slides sort of explain what I think the real thing is about. So the idea of a comprehensive proteomics chip is really simple. We have a robot over here. We get proteins coming in the door over here. We make photoaptamers to all these proteins. And you do it in some industrial scale, and then you make an Affymetrix-type chip. This is all our company is doing. This is it, okay? So this company with 50 people has one goal, is to make this chip, okay? We think the first of these chips will be available for scientists within less than a year, the beginning of next year. And at every position, there'll be a whole bundle of one aptamer, one photoaptamer, like the one on the last slide. And it's sitting there, and you'll get these proteins and binding specifically. But at this stage, before you've done the photochemistry, it's not going to be as clean as it will be. After you've made this cross-link, at that point, you can wash in denaturing solvents. You can wash in sodium hydroxide, where DNA is stable, get rid of all the noise. And at that point, on the chip, on the whole chip, the only source of primary amines are the lysines in the proteins that are stuck where they ought to be, because the aptamers have no primary amines. And so in principle, if you know how to stain with fluorescent stains a primary amine and not stain DNA, in principle you can get a signal and then quantify what's there. That's the idea, okay? Pretty simple, okay? Yeah, please.
So what I can put on the array, so presumably you want to select aptamer that binds a different protein. Mm-hmm. How many different kind of aptamers can you find that binds with this kind of specificity?
Well, so far every I want to say this in. Let me step over here and I'll leave it out later. So there's a robot that does the photo selects process, and the robot is. Can do 100 different proteins in 2 to 3 days. And we have two of them. So in principle, we could do a few hundred different proteins a week. Okay? And from the data so far, we think, but we haven't done this enough to know, that every photoaptamer we make will bind to one and only one protein. In detail, the chance that that's right is zero. There's no chance that's going to happen. But when we find one that isn't good, we just will not put it on the chip.
Do you have an idea of what's the fraction of the, let's say, 50,000, 100,000 proteins that the body makes?
Yes.
Would bind to one specific aptamer with this kind of a...
Oh, yeah, I do. So we've done 200 different proteins, but not for photo selects. That's a much smaller number. And every protein that's been tried for regular classic selects has yielded a high affinity aptamer.
And these are different different types of
proteins. Oh yeah, enzymes, everything, anything that you can put in a tube. You can make aptamers to amino acids, you can make aptamers to ATP, you make them to anything. People have made them, we did, accidentally, to millipore filters, nitrocellulose filters, whoops. Well, so I mean, you learn, you know, this is genetics, you know, so in a funny way, whatever you put in the tube is what you get. You actually have to be careful that you get to what you put in the tube, not what's in the tube before you put it in the tube. Hi. Well, we are automating it now, and the answer is we don't know, because in the end, to sell these chips for researchers, you don't have to do anything. They'd be so happy, because this is better than a 2D gel. And so we think that'll be the first market. The FDA is not going to be quite so forgiving, which is what the last half of this talk is about, okay? The last. But we don't know. We're sort of just confronting that. We don't know. Right? I hope it's not a lot, okay? Because we for sure can make a lot of them. And it'd be nice if we didn't find that now there's a new rate limiting step that we never thought about, right? Which is what you're worried about.
Still, I don't understand this protein. It has many different types of things. Well, different, depending on where you look at it, the different pockets and so forth. So you could have different aptamers that eventually, when they would start to affinity to the same protein. At what point does that become important, like a protein can be multiplied?
So I think you're asking a question about data handling and redundancy on the chip is what I'm hearing your question is. So let's say that's the one protein. And let's say that there are, in spite of our experimental data so far, several epitopes that will be recognized by a photoaptamer, one here, one here, one here. In a perfect world, we'd put several different aptamers that do here, several here, maybe 10 different ones, at 10 different addresses on the chip, and then we'd figure out some averaging that we did. But in the end, what I want to tell you is that this is all about pattern recognition. Where we're headed here is empiricism. I don't give a hoot about biology at this point. I'm too old, because nobody's going to understand this ever. So what I want to do is measure everything. People in academics, they always get mad at me, because I was a big NIH guy for a long time. Say, this is not hypothesis-driven science. You know? Well, it is. The hypothesis is if I measure everything and you measure less, I'll know more than you do. That's my hypothesis. It's
But thus far, for every protein, you just find one aptamer is the best.
Well, I didn't say that. That I didn't say. I didn't mean to say that if I did say it. You find many sequences of different aptamers that share things and bind to the same site if you drive the thing to the stringency that we drive it to.
Your overall length is like 40 base pairs.
Plus the fixed sequences, yeah, which might get you to 70.
But this conserved part of an aptamer is either 10 base pairs.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I want to do it in a different way. I want to answer. I do want to answer. I'm not trying to avoid you. We did a slightly more sophisticated analysis about 5 years ago, in which we took all the sequences that we would get for each target protein and did this Tom Schneider information content analysis, because he did that in my lab. So that was what I knew how to do. And we were able to compute from those bits that we got out the frequency. And that is a more telling number, I think, than me saying that it's 6 nucleotides in a row. You agree? And what we learned was that what I would have to recalculate, because I can't do this in my head, is that the frequency in a big pool of potential aptamers for every target varied from 1 in 10 to the 9th, i.e. not much information, to 1 in 10 to the 13th. i.e. more information, as though those guys had more nucleotides of conserved stuff. But if, so I can almost do that. So, you know, it's 10 nucleotides. It's not many. That's not my point, okay?
But in this particular slide, you showed it was
That's a rare one. They don't usually look, they're shorter and dispersed. Okay. That as a teaching slide, that one was good, but it apparently mistaught you. I'm so sorry. Okay. Okay. See, you got the idea? Okay.
Are you interested in a binary question here? Is it presence or absence of the person, or are you interested?
No, it's got to be quantitative.
Quantitative. Has to be. Concentration.
Concentration. Well, so let's assume that you don't get the absolute concentration out of what we're planning to do, but what you get is something that I think is good enough, so it's the right question. Let me tell you what you do get. The aptamer will have a KD, and that will affect what fraction of the protein that we do that's in the sample, call it serum, that's going to end up on the chip, because at the point that you irradiate. So that's variable, what fraction of the protein that was in the solution you'll get. Then, for the photoaptamers we characterized carefully, the cross-linking efficiency, since you're not going to cross-link square by square, you're going to do the whole chip, and there's a range of cross-linking efficiencies. Probably will end up being 40 to 100% is my bet from the data we have so far. So there's going to be another sort of undeterminable, you can't make it all the same. All you can do during the photosynthesis process is make the irradiation times the similar to what you're going to be doing on the chip. Okay, so you don't have a way to vary that on the chip. Then each protein will have its own size and its own lysine abundance. And I think, from our data so far, but can't be sure, of course, because we haven't done enough of this, that the lysines will be completely reacted because we're going to be in denaturing conditions, and we'll be able to do that to completion. So the three variables are the affinity of the aptamer, the cross-linking efficiency, and the lysine abundance. Therefore, the fluorescent signal we get at any spot will not be a direct measure of the protein concentration, but if that spot goes up and down, when a sick person is compared to a healthy person, I don't care, I think. Okay? Are you comfortable with that? Okay.
Do I understand correctly that you can't do a two-color experiment?
No, you could, but it's trickier. Okay. I don't know that you can't, but we don't want to. Would you like me to? I would rather do it by normalizing to lots of other stuff and not doing that.
So that means you really have to know well the concentration of stuff you put in to start.
The concentration of
you're going to take some sample and you're going to grind it up and get protein.
No, we're going to take serum, so that's a little easier. I'm not disagreeing. I don't mean to cut you off, because what you're saying is for sure. You could be Dr. FDA right now. I mean, somebody's going to say these things. So the normalization is a big deal. The reason I don't want to do red, so we've talked about this. Imagine that we decided that we were going to do a standard serum that had been dyed with red dye, and then we took the unknown serum and we did green dyes and we mixed them together and we did the experiment. That would be perfect. The only thing wrong with it is that we've selected the aptamers to the undyed protein. And the time I want to dye the protein is down here, because the proteins, as you dye them, you lose everything you work so hard to get. You know, so this is about, these are conformational epitopes. So I think that's an unproductive way to go. But if you have an idea, I'm going to be here until tomorrow and when I go on my airplane. If you have an idea that's better than what I just said, find me, please. Okay, because it's a big question. Okay? Okay, so I want to spend 2 minutes on one thing and then drive ahead to where I think the math gets sort of interesting, okay? So this is what I've told you about in that slide about extra specificity for photoaptamers. What I basically said is that this is going to be as good as what people do with antibodies. So what do people do with antibodies? They have incredibly specific immunoassays for specific analytes. They all involve sandwiches. So when I told you that cross-linking rate constant is a specificity determinant, the way you have an equivalent specificity determinant in immunoassays is that you have a capture antibody, and then a second antibody that recognizes a second epitope on the same protein, a non-overlapping, and it's the multiplication, it's the product of that specificity and that specificity that gets you clean enough to do what we did in serum on that gel slide. So we get to do something with a single agent that has the dual specificities of a sandwich assay. And if you think in a simple-minded way about comprehensive proteomics, as you start making in an array antibodies aimed at every protein and secondary antibodies aimed at every protein, you then lose all the advantage of sandwiches, because whoever binds to the primary capture antibody will be recognized by a secondary antibody that's in the same assay system. So the only reason that sandwich assays work is that you're only doing the experiment in one tube with one capture antibody. Once you have 100,000 capture antibodies, then you have to you eliminate all of the value of sandwiches. Okay. So we've actually recently decided that this is the only way to do this, okay, if it's worth doing. Okay. So anyway, so we're excited that that's true. That shows we can do what I said. We don't care about that. You don't care about that. I had a slide. I love this slide right here. Here's a summary about proteomics. It says down here something. Just assume this, okay? Just assume we can do all that, okay? So that I don't want to spend any time on that. So I want to spend the last 20 minutes on what the issues are about how you would use data for disease screening. So that the whole company, the whole idea that I'd like to spend the last 20 minutes on is that you ought to be able to make a chip, if it's done right, that you use to screen for disease. So this has become my passion, all right? So, and the reasons are many. You have to do something. And the other reasons include that there are lots of diseases that are awful, that if you find them early, they go from being awful to being trivial. So my wife had a melanoma, and if she had taken it off early, she's fine now, so this is not one of these tearjerkers, although it could have been. If she had gone to the doctor a year earlier and taken that thing off, it would have been like a wart. When she did go, it was no longer just a wart because it was 2 millimeters deep. At 2 millimeters deep, a melanoma, you have a 50% chance of dying. If it's 4 millimeters deep, you have a 100% chance of dying. And if you go before it's 2 millimeters deep, it's like there's nothing. So, and you have years to figure this out, okay? So for her, it was just, you know, a little blemish on her foot, okay? So it's this idea that in blood there might be things that you can do to save people from death with trivial surgeries. Her surgery took 5 minutes, okay? So the difference between having a blood test and a 5-minute surgery, so, you know, that's, to me, that's worth working on a little bit, okay? Now, I've said to my wife many times that, while I'm glad she didn't die, there have been times I wanted to kill her, which is what I want to say. But that's just human, right? So I want to give you what the model is and then show you what we think the data are going to look like. So if you said to me today, how big are your chips today? We have no chips today. So that's about it, some other execution problem. So don't worry about that, because we're building up this bioinformatics group knowing we think what the data are going to look like, okay? So, but we don't have any data, so we can only talk about what we think the data are going to look like. The problem is that today no one knows what you should measure. The reason we have to do this comprehensively is that if you go to the literature, there's a slide that says this. So I could ask this question: how many blood tests do you think measure a protein and tell the patient something that's binary clean? You have So how many of those blood tests do you think there are that actually say with accuracy you have from a single analyte? You ready? How many? Yeah. Well, there are a few hundred that are measured. Okay, so that part's good. The number that are clean, protein analyte measurements that tell you something clean, is 1. And that's for pregnancy. And that's it. That's astonishing, huh? And it's just astonishing, okay, to me, okay? And so I'm going to give you an example of what this problem. So this ends up being a problem that is about multiple markers, unless as we start measuring more things, we find things like HCG that are a marker for breast cancer, a marker for prostate, a marker for liver, then everything becomes one test and then it's easy, okay?
The thing is a disease, rather than a protein. It's a diagnosis or something, rather than a presence.
Well, that's right, but measuring the protein HCG in urine for a woman is, and I'll show you why in a slide in just a second, actually does tell you that it's not a disease. I don't want you to think that I said that in front of this little kid. It's a state pregnant. But so what we want to be able to do is take all the data and make a binary statement about disease, not a binary statement about the protein. That, is that clearer than what I said? I'd hope to have said that. Yes, that's what I mean, okay? And the only disease that we can do that with is the only state we can do that with is pregnancy today, okay? There's nothing else where a marker tells you anything with that kind of clarity. So prostate cancer is a really interesting example. We've studied this really hard, that is, studied the literature. And there's a paper published with what you really need, which is the data for people who are healthy and the people who are sick, okay? And the people who have prostate cancer. And there's a wonderful paper with 12,000 measurements of people. Men over 45 were studied in this thing. And I want to show you what the data look like because there's a terrifically accurate test. This PSA test measures PSA levels accurately. So what is the distribution? Because that's what we're talking about, right? So this is the normalized data. And it's kind of interesting. So these are people who don't have prostate cancer. This is their distributions. And these are the people who do, okay? The 3% of those 12,000 people who do, okay? So that's the incidence is about 2.9% in men over 45. And so you immediately see what the problem is, I mean, and why this test is not so good. The problem is that people down here who are right in here who have prostate cancer look normal, and people who are here are the false positives who look like those, the purple line, who people think have prostate cancer. So you have false negatives and false positives, just like you would have in anything. And that's the source of the problem. So that's the same curve. So the difference between these two curves, a person without prostate cancer, a person with, for HCG levels in urine, if you call this not pregnant and this pregnant, this curve is over here, so they're not overlapped. So that's what it takes for a marker to be able to tell you about a state change. You need something where it's near 99.99%, and I want to come to that number in a minute. So this is the data for prostate cancer. You don't care about that. So this is another way of looking at the data for prostate cancer. If you take the absolute levels of PSA protein measured in this antibody test, and you plot the levels against the probability that you have cancer, when you're way down in here, it's not a very good test, right? And in fact, the number that people use for saying you have to be followed up is about 5. Okay? So it's at about 15% of the people who actually have 15% of people who are told that they should do more work, more workup, 15% actually have prostate cancer. But it's reasonably arbitrary, right? I mean, you could decide that you want your cutoff to be here, right? You could say it wherever you want. It's just a question of how many you want to miss. So out here, you'd be about 80% accurate, but you'd miss everybody that has prostate cancer. So you have this problem, this tension between not wanting to miss people that you can do something about, and the false positives that it's all the expense in the system, okay, plus all the unpleasantness. So and the same is true for mammography. We've also done a completely equivalent analysis of mammography. Mammography is a wonderful thing for women to do. The bulk of the women, it's probably 85% again, like it is for PSA. I don't know the number exactly because I'd forgotten it, but it's about the same number. Who have a positive mammogram on further workup turn out not to have breast cancer. And that further workup includes a second mammogram, it includes a biopsy, after this, if the second mammogram is positive, because in fact it's frightening to a woman who had a positive one, who then gets told that the negative one is the definitive one, because she's got an IQ over 103, and she says, wait a minute, why didn't you think the first one was the right one? You know, one for two, how did you do it? Do you do it 12 more times? No, you go in where you think it is, and you do a biopsy. So there's a huge number of false biopsies, and of biopsies that show no pathology, during which time the woman is scared to death. Okay, so there's tremendous cost to the system, both emotional and dollars. So we think that if you had PSA-like markers with that kind of distribution, as opposed to the HCG mutants, that it ought to be simple to take independent markers and to figure out simple algorithms that give you definitive binary calls. And for the time that I'm here between now, I mean, you guys would know more about this, obviously, than I do. And we have a really strong math group at SomaLogic with really wonderful people. And so this is by way of saying, gee, if this problem interests any of you and you have something to contribute and want to think about it, you know, send me an email or come visit us. We'll pay you to come visit us. And you can talk to these guys and we can figure out whether you know something that we better know, because this is, I think, the heart of it. Okay, you know, all of the great stuff about how this is going to be used. Everybody in the world thinks at this end about diagnostics. When you're at this end, you've already found out you had disease. Almost every disease, breast cancer, because of mammography being getting to be not that way, most diseases start by the patient noticing the symptoms or noticing in their child the symptoms. And the whole model here is the symptoms are just too late. We've done an analysis of the literature, and it's clear already from this incredibly stupid experiment done by Oxford Glycosciences, which is such a great experiment, but impossible to do for screening. So they did, you can see what it says here, they're a company that did 2D gels. So you know, on 2D gels, you can measure 1,800 proteins. They're the 1,800 most abundant proteins in your serum. So that's not where all the action is in biology. The action is down where the concentrations are lower. Already on the little chips that we've made to get started, we're able to measure protein concentrations that are 500 to 1,000 times lower than what you can see in 2D gels, and we expect it to get even better. And even in this experiment, which is pretty well defined, the 2D gels gave protein signatures from the serum of healthy women versus women with either minor breast, you know, early breast cancer or advanced disease. So you sort of have the beginnings of thinking that protein signatures are going to exist. You just got to go get them, right? So that's the sort of model, right? You don't care about this. You should, but you don't. I don't care about that. Well, I mean, you should. That's what I want to say. So the first chip that we're going to have, this is the goal, is oncology. And the reason is that it's one where there are already data that protein signatures between a person with an early tumor and one without one are going to be different. Protein levels are going to be different. And it's the situation where early diagnosis is for sure a good idea. So if you had a chip now to find out when someone was merely befuddled versus when he had Alzheimer's, you wouldn't do that because there's nothing you can do about it. Why would you do that? But for cancer, you would do it. So we've been focused on these nine cancers up here. The incidence of those nine cancers in the United States is about one person in 300 per year, okay? So now you get to see an interesting number, okay? What if we had a perfect test? And what if we could bring the cost of the test down to $100? So that's this number, $100. There were no false positives, no false negatives. The chance that that's gonna be true is zero, but you gotta get as close to that as you can. So if it was perfect, it would cost you $30,000 to find that one person in 300 who had cancer. It's the simplest of things. So is a country like the United States or, you know, Western Europe or Japan going to spend $300 $30,000 to find a person with cancer that's curable if you find them. And so there's a lot of study done about breast cancer. So there's, we know that number in the United States and Finland. The number is $70,000. It's mostly because of the workups of the false positives that that number's so high. But that's the real number. So if you could do that, but think about the poor FDA. They're going to have, you're going to, can you imagine, you go to the FDA, they've never seen anything about aptamers, they don't know photoaptamers, they don't know proteomics, they don't know anything, and you go in and you say, I've got a test for 9 tumors, can we do it? So you can imagine that the regulatory hurdles here are going to be huge, and we have to expect it to be slow. This is, I think, my last slide, yeah, it is. So what I've just been saying for the last 2 minutes or so, or 5 minutes, is that there's an interplay that's pretty important, which is between the cost of the chip, so we're busy picking a chip partner to work with us, and, you know, you, some of you who are experimentalists know how much an Affymetrix chip costs to go do it. It costs $500 or $1,000. So if it costs $500 or $1,000, you can't do the test for $100, right? So that's a problem. And make it up in volume, right? So you can't do that. So there's this is a very, very big issue for commercial diagnostics. Not for research, which is what the Affymetrix chip is, but for screening. And of course, then there's this interplay between the incidents. So how are we going to, over time, go after diseases that are one person in a million? Uh-oh. If the test costs $1, it costs you $1 million to find that person if you had a perfect test. You can't do that, okay? It's not going to happen. So our whole strategy is to go after the high incidence diseases and then keep adding aptamers to the chips, because the incremental cost of adding aptamers and informatics to the chip is zero.
But not these chips aren't independent. I mean, one chip will not only measure
it. That you could do it all at once. That's right, you could do it all at once.
So you combine.
That's the whole idea. And ultimately, over time, if you got into the market with an oncology chip, then if you did your job right and you slowly but patiently kept showing more disease signatures to the FDA, you could make that diagnostic binary call to the patient. You've got, you know, Lou Gehrig's disease or something that's much more rare. So you've got to get into the market with something where the cost of screening is acceptable. And then there's no incremental cost. So you could go from an oncology chip to a wellness chip, if you think of it in those terms, for no extra money. And that's the idea. I mean, that is the idea. So I think this is going to happen. There are only about 4 companies now in the world that are trying to do this, each with their own proprietary technology. And if you had Jack Szostak, who knows aptamers really well, come here and talk about Phylos, the company that's trying to do this with sandwiches of fibronectin instead of antibodies, he would say, you can't do that aptamer stuff, you got to do it. So I don't care. Somebody's going to do this, okay? It's kind of, whether it's them or us, somebody's going to do this, because it's so clear that you could if you just put your mind to it. So you had a question. A pre-selection. Yeah, sure. So, it's very easy. So, if you, for example, were going to screen, so today, smokers go and get X-rays or you know, CT spiral X-ray or whatever their fancy name they're getting, and it doesn't work at all. Actually, it's 12% accurate or 14%, but nobody can get their hands on the data, so it's not clear how good it is. But people will pay if they know they're at high risk for a diagnosis that saves their life. I know the numbers for lung cancer, which is, can I just say that, and then we'll talk about that for a second. This is fascinating. There's a lung cancer group at the University of Colorado in Denver, at the Health Sciences Center, and they've shown us all these data. So both of my parents died of lung cancer, and they both followed exactly the progression of the disease. It took 6 months for each of them to die, and no one lives. I mean, it's 99%+ die within 6 months to 8 months. And the reason is that you're never diagnosed, until you've really got a very large tumor, okay? Because that's the first time that you're short of breath and you're congested and you're all that other stuff. When people are diagnosed with even small cell and non-small cell lung cancer, so all of the word, everything you think is awful, by accident, okay? So you're out there playing pitch and catch with your kid, and your shoulder hurts. You go in to get a X-ray, which is useless anyway, and the guy looks through your shoulder and sees this big thing in your lung and says, "Gee, what's that?" If the tumor is 3 centimeters across or smaller, surgical resection of a 3 centimeter or smaller lung tumor saves the person's life 60% of the time. That's astonishing. It's that big. Okay? Didn't metastasize. 60% of the time, local surgery saves your life. You die of something else. It's astonishing. Okay? So for sure, smokers would be nuts to not do this early. So pre-selection and pre-screening of audiences for this may be the way it starts. I'm really driven to wanting to do this screening for everybody. And so there's a question that will only come from the data. So one of the data sets, since we're doing this all empirically, the people from the Health Sciences Center are going to give us all the serum that they've been collecting for years of people who have advanced lung cancer and other stages of lung cancer. And so we'll figure out if there's an economically feasible argument to make that people who have been smoking for 17 years should ought to do this. But in the end, you would like it to be for everybody, right? So I'm really focused on how to get into the screening market for people who are asymptomatic and not at risk. I mean, the other thing people say, which I guess I should stop, people are always trying, well, how does this compare with genetic predispositions, which is another group that you would do more often, right? So we thought about it mostly in terms of markets, really, because we, you know, we're a company. So if you, eventually, in the out years, 20 years from now, I imagine people will get genetically profiled at birth once. It's not going to change. When at your bar mitzvah, you're going to have the same DNA that you had before, right? So once, whereas what we're talking about is a surveillance, you know, once a year or something like that. So the market is 100 times bigger, and if we do a good job, you would do it on people who were not at risk, because even, I mean, the awfulness of having a disease that you could have been saved from is not less awful because you were not at high risk. I mean, there's none of these diseases that you only get if you're, lung cancer is now 15% are non-smokers. So you really want to make this drive as fast as you can to everybody, I think. No.
You might have something that you call prostate cancer that might have, you know, two people that have prostate cancer might have totally different signatures that do not overlap.
That's the interesting part. And so the great part about it is no one knows. There are no data. Okay? So I know how I got to thinking that there would be overlap. Okay? So let's take cancer as an example. Stay there. So for sure, the mutations that cause the cancer to get started are going to be different from tumor to tumor. So that's a given, okay? There will be sets of people that have one, sets of people have another, but even people will have often different mutations in the same gene, so, you know, so that's going to vary. But as the disease progresses, so that first moment when the tumor is, you know, 3 cells, okay? So that isn't so dangerous, right? So that's not the problem. The question really is, the biology question, is what's going to happen as the tumor progresses? I think the inflammatory response, the immune response, the angiogenic responses, I think those are going to be the same. I think they're going to be dead cells. So I think from lung cancer, there will be proteins that are intracellular lung tissue proteins that show up in blood. And they'll show up in blood independent of how that tumor started or what its little, you know, trick things are. You know, they'll all be fighting, but along the way, they'll all be dying. And they'll be pumping their debris into blood. So I think there will be, I can't prove this, there are no data. So, you know, this is one of these things. But we decided that we were going to go for it anyway. And it is the reason that we tooled up to do 100,000 aptamers in a short time instead of 47 that we thought were important. Because every time somebody says something that they think is important, it turns out to go away, right? So the idea is to do it empirically, and if we're right that there will be overlap, then we'll be okay. If there are three different sets of people that have prostate cancer that have three different protein signatures, the math ought to see that. That's not a problem. The real problem will be that everyone is so different from everyone else, and the data there don't support that. The data are already strong enough for gene expression and breast tumors and things of that kind. So I don't think that's going to happen, but... Absolutely. Yep. Absolutely. Every drug works for 30% of the people that get it. First approximation. So wouldn't it be nice if you had an outcomes measurement that was real? And how are you feeling, Mrs. Jones, is not real. So I think this will all happen. There'll probably be drug selections based on, it's done now. So I don't know, since I don't know how much pyrimidine chemistry you know, but there are these anti-cancer compounds that, like 5-fluorouracil is a common one. And it turns out that human beings have different levels of the enzyme that reduces across the 5-6 double bond, and that affects essentially the drug concentration, because once you've done that reduction, you're not an active compound anymore. The Mayo Clinic, they measure that enzyme prior to giving you the drug, because human beings vary from 0 to 10 times the average for that enzyme level. If you have the high level, the drug doesn't work at all. If you have none of that enzyme, or very, very low, the drug kills you. So that's what you're talking about personalized drug selection. And that's going to come too. And this will be part of that, I hope. Yeah? I only heard the first half. Say it again. Sorry. So you have to. I want to be really clear about where we are, right? But say that again. That's so interesting. Just say it again. Don't. Yeah, I think that the first chips will have every single thing that you can think of today. Every protein that you name today, whose name you know, and that's not squirreled away in a genomics company where we don't yet know about it. That every protein that you can buy, beg, borrow, will have its cognate aptamer on the first chips. When they don't tell you anything, they will be part of the controls, if you will, in the statistics to average out, because we got to know about the distributions of everything. Because no one knows, except for things like PSA. There are very few data sets that you can get your hands on to see what the variation is in healthy people. So we don't know that. So we need to know that for every one of these proteins. And so they'll all be there. And so we're going to be open to every surprise. Okay. I mean, one of the problems, which is statistically interesting, is that if you have too many aptamers on the chip and you make two sets of people, so you know this probably better than I do, you say, here's the healthy ones, here's the sick ones, can you split the profiles into the healthy and the sick people? The answer is you will. If you have 100,000 aptamers and 50 healthy people and 50 sick people, I guarantee you, you're going to split them into two groups. The problem is that the next person in, you're going to have a 50-50 chance of getting it right. Right, because you right. So that so, but we're going to have everything. The whole driver is, more aptamers on the chip as fast as we can make them. Okay.
I have a question about one of your earliest slides where you did show the infinity of particular aptamer, many different proteins.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them were related, some of them were not. The one for which you trained this aptamer had 100% infinity. Most of them had their low 0.05 or something.
Or lower, but some.
One of them had something like 2%.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you train an aptamer for this protein, and you compare, would it also have 2% for the first one, if it's reciprocal?
No one knows that, and I don't know that either. But I want to show you something that'll make you happy. Could I do that? Let me show you one thing. The way this slide, which is too busy, is the way the robot selects the aptamers. And the protein that was on that slide you're talking about, basic FGF, in this slide would be that protein on the bead. These are magnetic beads. And there's a liquid handling device that goes ahead and selects the photoaptamers. Historically, we've done that in buffer. And in fact, there isn't any reason to get a little more specificity, a little specificity kicker, since we have high concentration of the analyte that we intend to measure on the bead. There isn't anything that says we can't put serum in the buffers. So in principle, we can drive away from that. That 2% guy was a homologue, was a member of the FGF family. It was FGF 4 or 5, I can't remember which one it was. But we could imagine getting even a third incremental specificity during the selection to the other two I've been talking about. If not, in the end, 2% only hurts you if the protein is 50 times more abundant than the one you're trying to measure. You know, this is all about, and there will be some that we just can't get. But because this is empirical, and we hope that everything is over-specified, we think that 1% to 2% of the proteins are going to go up and down with basically everything. So we can have some misses, okay? Things we can't measure.
Well, my question wasn't about misses, but rather I'm trying to figure out what it's doing at all.
Oh, I'm sorry. No one has, that in that slide, I can show you which ones, I can tell you, but the detail is what you're asking about, which is kind of wonderful. So I know exactly what slide, I'm sorry. I know it's lunchtime, sorry. But since you asked. Yes, that's right here. So this 2% is this one over here. So the ones that we've done aptamers to, like basic FGF, and made a table just like this, are FGF7, which is has another name, keratinocyte growth factor, but not FGF5. We've done PDGF, VEGF, IL-8, and thrombin. And all of them are specific, but what you're really asking is, would if we made an aptamer against FGF5, if that's what it is, my eyes are bad here, would it cross-react more with this than if we did any of the other? And we never did that. So yeah, that would be an interesting question, whether those dominant epitopes overlap more, is what you're saying. Or is this just a fluke? And if we had taken one of the other 14 aptamers we got aimed at basic FGF in the original selection, would this number 2% have been lower? We don't know that either. It's not. It's a miss. It's because I've not emphasized how hard we drive these things. We make these things more and more stringent. We lower the concentrations of the proteins. We lower the concentration of the aptamer pool. We decrease the incubation times to make. And so we keep driving toward the winner. We force there to be a winner. In principle, if we didn't do that, if that's the protein, there's nothing about the protein on this side and this side that in principle are different. And if you can bind here and not have any impact on binding here, and if we don't make it more and more stringent in terms of KDs, then you have to get something over there.
So
you're saying that there is, so that there's sort of a stochastic decision at some point made, and then you drive, so you selected a winner early on, and then you're optimizing it further and further and further.
No, I don't. I wouldn't have said it that way. I think that's not what I'm saying. I think what I'm saying is that you'll start by picking, you work at high protein concentration in the beginning and high aptamer concentration, long incubation times, and you get perhaps 0.1% of the aptamer pool that binds, okay? Most of that binds poorly. And then you take that and amplify, and as you keep making the binding conditions more stringent, you are throwing out guys that bind less quickly or less tightly, especially on the robot, because in the robot we wash the beads, so things that have faster dissociation rate constants fall off. So I think that it's the stringency of the selection that drives you to thinking that there's a magic patch on the protein that's unlike anything else. I don't think that can be true, because in three individual amino acids have been used to generate aptamers, and they all worked. You know, individually as amino acids. So if amino acids work, how can there not be patches everywhere? It's just about the relative binding capacity of those epitopes to a nucleic acid aptamer, I think.
Perhaps it's not surprising that this specificity is possible, because the number of combinations for three dimensions is, say, 1.8 to the n that a neuropolymer can take. So that to the 40 is much bigger than the number of protons you are considering, which is 10 to the 5th. Mm-hmm. So, if you were getting a reasonable sense of that, then you'd be
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's as true for different epitopes on the same protein as it is for... So, how many epitopes are on a protein? How many patches of the right size are there on a protein is what you're really... You're asking as much about the different patches on a protein as you are about the specific, because they're, in principle, they're the same. Unless you, right? Okay. And that's the reason that we think serum in the buffers is also going to help. Right? No data.
You've got many different aptamers for different proteins on a tube. Mm-hmm. And the strength of binding of the best one for each protein is going to be different, right? So you've driven it up as far as you can go. Right? Mm-hmm. But the strength of binding of the best one is now dependent on which protein you're talking about. So maybe now you're trying to do them all at the same time on one chip. Does that actually matter?
I think not, but I think that you could convince me otherwise. I think so no one knows that. You model that, okay? And we expect this to be an equilibrium situation. We expect the chip to be rocked and shaken and, you know, gently stirred and all that stuff. And so we think that you can model this as though each little patch of aptamer is behaving independently, we think. But, you know, you could try to convince me that that's not the case, right? Yeah, you can try. I don't know what to do. No one's ever done this.
What conditions do you use?
Yeah.
Because you want to use fairly stringent conditions so that it's more specific.
We're going to use exactly the same conditions that we use to select these puppies, and the selection is going to be done almost for sure in serum. Okay. So, but you're still right. I mean, you know, so let's take the case of PDGF that was up here that binds to this aptamer at 0.1 with 0.1% of the with 1,000 times higher KD than the basic FGF. We have 100,000 aptamers there. What you're really asking is whether the PDGF will, in any event, reside on its own cognate aptamer and not the all the other non-specific ones that are there in excess over, that's what you're asking, right? And so, it's you know, until you start doing this, you can model this till the cows come home, but I think you gotta do it, okay? That is, isn't that your question? I think it is.
It's very high specificity still makes no sense to me. But let's assume that the one aptamer only binds to this protein. Aptamer A only binds to protein A. active B only binds to protein B. Okay? Now, often the case in protein, you can join different domains together, join different proteins together. So now if I join these two together without touching these domains, then we'll have one protein that will have two active recognizers. What prevents that from happening?
That will happen. And I. No, but that's okay. So don't forget. So wait. So let me. You're asking what's going to happen on the chip. Will you measure the same protein at two different? So that's in the list of things. When I think you asked, is this going to be? Are you going to be able to know anything about the absolute concentrations of proteins? The answer was no already because of KDs, cross-reaction, numbers of lysines. So now you have another case. So every single diagnostic that's done for proteins, somebody always has a measurement. And then later, someone else makes a slightly different assay, and instead of calling it free, they call it bound. They never know what they're doing. But what they really mean is that they're measuring, they get different levels, okay? And then there's a lot of hand-waving about how in one of the assays or another, it's measuring something that's bound to something else as opposed to free. So the words are never defined, okay? So think about what we're trying to do. We don't care about the actual concentrations of proteins. All we care about is going up and down with disease. Yeah, but so if it meant that you had, let's say you had an aptamer for, let's talk about a heterodimer of proteins A and B, okay? So and now we have aptamer for A and aptamer for B, and they're sitting over here. This aptamer is going to collect heterodimer AB. This one's going to collect the same heterodimer by a different epitope, AB. At the moment that you cross-link this one to one subunit, this one to the other, and wash under denaturing conditions, then you're now clean again. So what you've really impacted is the distribution on those two aptamers because of the fact that the things can distribute.
That's fine, but now you have a heterodimer AB and a heterodimer AC. So then this aptamer A will bind to both the AB and AC.
But won't cross-link. The cross-linking will be done. The proteins that are used to make the aptamers will give a cross-link to one subunit or the other, but not both. So if call it hemoglobin. Okay, so you got alpha and beta. So if you cross-link to alpha and you wash in SDS and urea, beta falls off.
What I mean is really a protein that's already sort of linked together by the backbone. So you have a protein that has different domains that's connected.
Sorry. So you've done alternative splicing and things of that kind. Sure. Great. So yeah, so that'll add to the complexity. If you just keep thinking it's patterns, not knowledge, then you're okay. I mean, I don't care what sits on the chip at address A, B, C, or D. I care only that I know what goes up and down those signals with disease. So while the FDA at some point, so am I still missing?
As far as it seems to me, might have an aptamer that does not, that might recognize a protein A
and
another protein
A,
C.
Mm-hmm.
So the uniqueness is gone at that point. That might be important for you.
Oh, it very well could be. I'm not disagreeing. So alternative splicing, which is a big deal, is going to make.
So let's say they have an aptamer. You have aptamer that recognize a kind of.
Uh-huh.
Now, there's so many different kinds of kinases, then so if they recognize a common kinase domain, then you'll pull out.
But that's different. The kinases are not more similar than these. So that's different. That one is not. So I think you're asking a better question than that one.
I don't understand what are these things targeting? What part of the protein is
Well, that's what I think, but I think I'm missing something important because.
What
do
you possibly get the specificity?
know, typical energy scale for KC, and so how do you get something that binds 4KC better to one thing than to a home law? Do you understand the biophysics of that?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, I'll show you how. So first of all, let me tell you a fact. So there's an aptamer. So maybe this will help you. Okay. I don't know if it will. There's an aptamer that we selected to bind to a small molecule called theophylline. And theophylline is different than caffeine at one place in the molecule. The difference is that theophylline has a proton and caffeine has a methyl group. And the molecular weight of the two things is around 800 ballpark. Maybe 400, but I'm not sure. So here's my specificity argument that would make you both happy and leave me alone. But I want to think about this because obviously you're after. So if what you're asking about is how does this thing pick this surface here over a homolog surface? So we know a lot about the theophylline caffeine example. The reason caffeine doesn't bind is because of an atom clash. The methyl group is too bulky for the aptamer to bind where it binds, where in the case of theophylline, it's a proton. So think of this surface in the homolog as having a little iceberg here, okay? So then you're not talking about, you can talk about energetics if you want, but you can also use things that are not about energetics that are saying, gee, if that big bulky thing is there, I can't grab all the rest of it. So that's not sophisticated, but that gets you a lot of specificity. The specificity, the difference in the aptamer for theophylline and caffeine was 10 to the fourth on that same scale that I showed you before. The KD for caffeine was 10 to the fourth times higher, 10,000 times higher. No, our experiment was only aimed at theophylline. And what we said when we did this is we thought if we did caffeine, we would never get one that was 10,000 times better for caffeine because atom clash only works in one direction, right? It's the smaller thing, and that's true for the amino acyl tRNA synthetases with that set of things, glycine, alanine, being again, and glycine binds everything, right? So if you don't have any bulk there, then you can't use atom clash. So if you think that protein surfaces are bumpy, in some way, there's always some part of that interacting surface that'll have something sticking up, and so you don't have to do it in as rigorous a way as you do it, I think.
But there's something in your selection, you didn't ask for, you didn't look for discrimination, you're just looking for whatever binds the best. How does discrimination sort of come out as a side product?
So let me tell, I love it, of course, I don't know, okay, it's a miracle, all right? No, we can do whatever you want, but I mean, you shouldn't stop. I mean, you can stop. Yes.
You could take a unique protein. Then, how many you think there are sites on that unique protein to which you could make the same unique different aptamers?
Yeah. Well, what I think is that if you relax the demand, we don't know this. There's no data, but if we relax the demand for the potency of the binding and let the KDs go up, that you'd think that the specificity would go down. And we actually once wrote a paper about how, because there was no counter selection in our experiments of the kind you're talking about. So we don't know that at all, and we don't know how much worse the next best epitope is or how many there are. I mean, so a patch of protein, there are an infinite number of patches of protein on the surface if you just kind of start laying that thing, you know.
Okay. Then the question from a different side. Do you think that there are some unique proteins to which you would not be able to make a single aptamer?
Yeah.
This is a statistical question. And as far as the topography goes, the freedom in choosing your conformation or your topography in your aptamer by varying the sequence astronomically exceeds the freedom of the number of topologies you have in the protein.
Sure.
So that's 2 to the n, which is 40 or 50, which means to recognize which
how goes on.
The question is, certainly the conformation grows exponentially. And you can quantify this in different ways, in discrete
in discrete spaces in various lattices, you'll get an exponent about m at 1.0, 1.9. But I don't think that's, whether that exponent is 1.6 or 2.4, but you can choose the tolerance of your fit to an amount far less than the typical fluctuation of your protein space, not your possible protein space, but the 100,000 proteins that you have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
This is an unofficial discussion, right? Can I just, have you actually finished and said what you wanted to say?
Oh, long ago.
Because I think we need to call a halt.
Right? Oh, yeah, that's fine.
Whether you wanted to make a big finish.
No, I have nothing big to say, except I'm done.
So in this case, thank you very much.
Thank you.